I'm Diane Ravitch. I'm a professor of education at New York University. I'm a historian, and I've been studying schools and education since the late 1960s.
And I'm Holly Otterbein. I first asked Ravitch what she was trying to shed light on in her new book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools.
Well, I'd say that the first important thing about the book is that I look at all the claims, the narrative of that's called reform these days, and that the reform claim is that our schools are failing, they're declining, and that they're a threat to our future as a society. And I have a series of chapters in which I demolish all of these claims. So one is called the Facts About Test Scores, and what it shows is that test scores have never been higher in American history for white students, black students, Hispanic students, and Asian students. And then I looked at high school graduation rates. High school graduation rates, contrary to the popular myth, have never been higher for whites, blacks, Hispanics, and Asians. Then I looked at the dropout rate, and there are the facts on the U.S. Department of Education website. The dropout rates have never been lower than they are today. I looked at the international test scores and discovered, among other things, that when the first international tests were given 50 years ago, we came in last. And in the ensuing 50 years, we beat all of the other nations in terms of economic growth, democratic institutions, creativity, technological innovation. So I came to the conclusion that while we should care about, you know, we want to do better, but they don't predict the future. They don't predict whether you're going to be a successful nation. And so we shouldn't be beating ourselves over the head. But then after I had gone through all that analysis about the test scores, another set of international scores came out. And it turns out that our kids are tied with Finland in fourth grade and in eighth grade in science and math. And we're actually doing quite well. But the good news never got out because there is this media narrative that says we're in such bad shape. And so what I try to show using facts and documentation is our schools are really doing a terrific job. Our society is not doing such a terrific job because we have so much child poverty. And that where our schools are in fact in crisis is not because the schools are bad, but because of concentrated segregation and concentrated poverty. And where you find that combination of poverty and segregation, you find schools that are in terrible trouble because the kids are in terrible trouble, their families are in trouble, their communities are in trouble. And so there's no denying there's a crisis, but it's not a crisis of bad schools or bad teachers. It's a crisis of our society, which we are evading.
I asked if Philly schools are part of this group.
Philadelphia is one, but it's not the only one. There are inner city schools that are having exactly the same troubles, but they're right now, I'd say Philadelphia and Detroit would be the two worst off in the country because it's that combination of poverty and segregation and desperate underfunding. I mean, when I read about the budget cuts in the state of Pennsylvania and hear that there are only 19 librarians for all the schools of Philadelphia, it seems like there's almost a complete indifference to these children. If the people in Harrisburg making the decision, these decisions, had their children in the public schools of Philadelphia, they would be amply funded. But it's not their children, and it seems as though they just don't care.
And I asked Ravitch how she isolated poverty and segregation as the main factors and not teachers.
Because when you look at the data and you find out that our schools do incredibly well unless there's a lot of poverty. Where there are low poverty schools, test scores are good. Let's face it, we have an incredibly successful society. We have the biggest economy in the world. It was built by the 90% of people who graduated from public schools. And as a historian, I know that there is this long, long tradition of saying, oh, woe is us, our public schools are failing. People have been saying this probably since the 1820s. And so I have written books about the history of the 20th century, and in every decade you can find people saying, oh, the public schools aren't what they used to be. Well, I think today they aren't what they used to be for some reasons, because our society has changed. We have many, many children today, many more children who don't speak English than we did 30 years ago. We have many more children with disabilities, and some of them very severe disabilities, some of them environmentally caused, some of them just because our laws didn't protect them. Now we have laws that say they have a right to a free and appropriate public education. used to be, back when I went to school, they didn't have that right. So we have, the teachers are just overwhelmed with caring for children who come from, in many cases, desperate circumstances. And then we turn around and blame the teachers because the kids are not getting high test scores.
If not charter schools and market-driven reforms, I asked, what will improve public education in low-income cities like Philly?
The reason that I wrote this book is because I wrote a book 3 years ago that became a national bestseller called The Death and Life of the Great American School System, and it was how testing and choice are undermining the schools. And so the critics' complaint was, well, it's well and good that you make all these complaints. What are your solutions? So I had, this book is the solutions, and a third of the book is dedicated to saying this is what we should do. And number one would be to make sure that every woman who becomes pregnant and can't afford to get prenatal care gets prenatal care. And you might say, what has prenatal care got to do with schools? It's because when women don't get prenatal care, their children are likely to have developmental deficiencies, cognitive delays, and that means that many of these children who didn't get attended to when they were in utero will be special education, and we will spend hundreds of thousands of dollars on them in the course of their school life and many years after taking care of them because they didn't get good prenatal care. So a rather reasonable investment up front will pay off over a lifetime. You won't see the results in a year, but we will see the results in our society. I recommend also that early childhood education, I mean, everything I recommend has a huge research base, and I cite the research. Everybody knows that early childhood education is very important, and yet when we compare ourselves, or when the Economist magazine compared the advanced nations of the world in terms of where do they rank in supplying early childhood education of a high quality, we were number 24 amongst the top nations of the world. With prenatal care, we came in something like 130 and were ranked alongside Somalia. So we're really doing very badly in terms of providing the supports that families need and that children need to come to school ready. And the reality is that the achievement gap between poor kids and rich kids, between kids of different racial backgrounds, it's there on the first day of school. It's not caused by teachers, it's pre-existing. So we have to do everything we can to help children get ready for school, to come to school healthy and prepared to learn. There are many other things that are research-based, like reducing class size. Very crucial, and again, the research is just overwhelming, that particularly for kids, if they're English language learners, if they have disabilities, they need smaller classes. If they live in poverty, and they have not been exposed to a rich vocabulary at home, they will benefit by reduced class sizes. That costs money. It's expensive. But it's even more expensive if these kids later drop out of school, fall behind, drop out of school, and then go to prison. Turns out it costs $50,000 to $60,000 a year to keep someone in prison. It's much cheaper to give them a good education, reduce class sizes. Another thing that I recommend is having a full and rich curriculum for children, because particularly in the schools that are attended by poor children, the emphasis is simply on whatever's tested. So the kids who need a full education the most are not getting the arts. They're not getting the arts programs are either eliminated or they're threadbare. And they're not getting foreign languages, and they don't have science labs, they don't have librarians, they don't have guidance counselors, they don't have social workers. They're in a stripped-down situation that is almost penitentiary-like, and this is wrong. And I think it's very important to think about, I start the book with a quote from John Dewey that says, what the best and wisest parent wants for his child is what we should want for all the children of the community. And if you could think of what you want for your child, think of how does that compare what children of Philadelphia get, and it's a world of difference.
To me, it seems like Ravitch, in her writings, makes the argument that there is a deliberate underfunding of schools with low-income children. I asked her if that's what she really believes.
I actually think that there is a deliberate diversion of funds from public schools to privately managed schools, otherwise known as charters, and also a tremendous push to find ways to have vouchers. There are now 17 states that have vouchers where public money is being sent to religious schools and to schools of very low quality in many cases. Schools that are conducted in church basements or in somebody's backyard or in whatever. You know, it's just the push is just to get the money out of the government's hands and into someone's private hands. There is, and as I document in the book, there's a tremendous amount of corruption. In Pennsylvania, you have more cyber charters than any state in the country. You have 16 different cyber charters. These drain money away from public schools because they make political contributions. And so there are a number of politicians in Harrisburg, as there are in Ohio and some other states, where the corporations are making political contributions to pave the way for them to make a lot of money, but they deliver a very low quality of education, and it's been documented by low test scores, high dropout rates, low graduation rates. And when the kids drop out, the money stays with the corporation, and the kids go back to public school, and no money follows them because it's in the corporation. So these corporations turn out to be immensely profitable, and they deliver a very poor quality of education, and yet there's no accountability. If there were accountability, almost every single one of them would have been closed down by now. The same is true wherever you look. In Ohio, terrible virtual charters. In Tennessee, the virtual charter there, the Tennessee virtual charter, is probably the worst school in the state, certainly in the bottom 10%. No accountability. And it's because they're giving money to politicians.
So Ravitch believes there's a diversion of public funds. I asked, what's the end game? Who's doing it, and how does she know what their intentions are?
Well, I don't know what anyone's intentions are, other than it's clear that there are some people, I don't try to cast aspersion on motives other than to say that some people mean well. They think that if they're promoting charters or vouchers, they think they're helping poor children escape from failing public schools. I think that's wrong. As a matter of analysis, because what's called a failing school is a school that has a lot of kids in it that need help, and then the school is called a failing school. But there are people who are definitely in this for the money. There are tax breaks that are given to people who invest in charters. There is a federal visa program where you can get a green card. If you're a foreigner, you can get green cards for your whole family by investing $1 million in charter construction. There's a tax program called the New Market Tax Credits where you can double your money in 7 years or make a huge return. And there are for-profit charter companies that are clearly delivering substandard education and making a lot of money doing so. So there's definitely a profit motive, but I'm not attributing that to everybody.
The Pew Charitable Trust just released a poll showing that 52% of residents rated the public school system as poor. Conversely, about two-thirds had a positive outlook on charter schools. I asked Ravitch if she thinks there should be no charters despite public support for them.
Well, in my book, I have a chapter saying that charters are here to stay, but we should figure out what's the right way to have charters collaborate with public schools and not compete with them. I don't think that in this case public opinion would be persuasive because we've been subject over the past, especially 10 years, to a sustained propaganda campaign on behalf of charters saying that all charters are wonderful when we know by now all you have to do is look at any research and you find that the charters, if they have the same kids, get the same results. And that the charters that get very good results keep out the kids who don't speak English, keep out the kids with disabilities, kick out the kids who get low test scores. And if you do that kind of winnowing, you can get good results. But that way lies what I would call a dual school system, a charter system that can pick and choose its students and kick out the ones it doesn't like, and a public school that becomes like a dumpster system where kids are dumped that the charters didn't want. And that's not good for our society. That will destroy public education, and it will mean that the privatized sector is doing very well by being able to have this selective admissions policy. So I do think that there is a role for charters. I think that charters should do what public schools can't do and what they don't do well. I think the charters should be created and should take as their mission helping kids who've dropped out of school, finding them, bringing them back. I think there should be charters for autistic children. I think there should be charters for kids who've tuned out and just don't respond at all to what's on offer in the schools. And then the public schools could learn from those kinds of charters. What they can't learn from is the current kinds of charters, because when you say that a charter is successful because it's kicking kids out, that's not a lesson for public schools. So I would like to see more accountability on the part of charters. And all over the country, I've seen very, very bad charters that are never held accountable. In fact, there are charters that don't even have to take the state test and are not subject to the same rules and laws. So if you're going to have two sets of rules, that's not going to work. You will have one that's protected by political contributions and the other that's just for all the kids that got dumped out. I think that would be wrong.
The school district and the teachers union are currently negotiating a contract. The district is asking for work rule changes, among other concessions, that it believes will make the school system better. I asked Ravitch if she thinks that unions always have the best interests of children at heart, or if they're more about preserving the rights of teachers, even if that doesn't mean building the best schools.
First of all, I think that teachers have the best interest of children at heart. People don't become teachers in order to get a pension. I mean, when you're 21 years old and 22 years old and you graduate from college or get your graduate degree, your first thought is not, where can I get a pension and have a cushy job? People become teachers because they believe in children and they want to teach, they love their subject, or they love children. And if you ask teachers, they all say, in my experience, I became a teacher to make a difference in the lives of children. And I think that having a union is simply allowing teachers to have decent working conditions and also to protect academic freedom. That's why I believe that there's a value in due process. I think that if schools can simply kick out teachers, it will. What they'll do is they'll always want the cheapest teachers. So they'll keep a constant stream of young teachers, and if they stay too long, they'll get rid of them because they cost too much. And that's not good. And it's important to recognize that there's no country in the world that does this. I mean, when we look at the high-performing nations in the world and we say, we want to be like them, this is not what Singapore doesn't kick out older teachers. Neither does Japan or Korea or Finland or Canada. They have teachers unions. Finland has a teachers union in which not only are 100% of the teachers in the union, but 100% of the principals are in the union with them, and they have excellent schools. If you look at, in this country, at the states that are high performing, you would say it would be Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Jersey. Those are all three union states. So there's no reason why a union cannot coexist with good schools. And if you want to be like Mississippi, then, you know, go for it. That's a non-union state.
And I wrapped things up by asking Ravitch the million-dollar question: how do we as a society get the best teachers in front of the most disadvantaged kids?
I think that the first thing that Philadelphia needs is adequate resources for its schools. Right now, there is no way of making a decision about who are the best teachers and who are the worst teachers, certainly not based on test scores. Because if you use test scores, what you're going to be measuring is who has the easiest kids in their classroom. You will find that those who are teaching the kids with disabilities and with language difficulty are going to end up at the bottom of the pile because they have the hardest challenges. So you have to make judgments that are based on good professionalism. First of all, you need to have a superintendent who is an experienced educator. I don't know Dr. Height, but he is at least an educator. Many districts don't have educators at the top. You have to have principals who are themselves master teachers. And you have to have a system where professionalism is what matters most in selecting the staff. The evaluation system that I'm most impressed with is the one that's in Montgomery County, Maryland. It's called Peer Assistance and Review. And there, every teacher, when they enter the system, gets a mentor. And the mentor is an experienced master teacher. And then the mentor makes a judgment about whether the teacher is ready and reports to a committee of teachers and principals. And they say, great, Ms. Jones doesn't need a mentor anymore. She's a good teacher. Experienced teachers who are not doing a good job are reported to the committee, who then assign those experienced tenured teachers a mentor. And the mentor, after working with the experienced teacher, says, well, Mr. Brown cannot change, will not change. He's lazy, he's incompetent. Mr. Brown will be fired. And that works. The Peer Assistance and Review Committee has fired over 200 teachers based on professional judgment. So when somebody comes in and sells you snake oil and says, just pick the best, you have to know, you have to have some way of knowing who is the best. And I can promise you, using test scores is not the way to do it, because all test scores will tell you is who's teaching the most affluent kids and who's teaching the poorest kids, and somehow the best teachers are the ones who are in the most affluent districts and have the easiest classes. So you must rely on professional judgment. But even the best teachers cannot survive in a system that is desperately underfunded, where children have huge needs, and where that system does not provide the guidance counselors, the social workers, the psychologists, the teaching assistants, the librarians, all of these services that, frankly, 50 years ago, every school had, even in ordinary districts. And now we think this is something that only the wealthy can afford. And that's been a big change in our society. We have, as a society, we have abandoned our obligation to make our schools the best in the world. And in particular, I think we're abandoning children of color in the inner city. And Philadelphia right now is case number one.